Hello. Today in the Loopcast, I have Andrew from Attaché Films. Sorry, I probably butchered that, but he is one of the content creators, or the content creator behind one of my favorite series right now on YouTube called Checkmate Lincolnites. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of it. There's a few threads going into the show. One is this general sort of examination of how do you normalize extremism, right? So we have this understanding of why a Klan person believes in the ideology of the Ku Klux Klan, or why somebody believes in sort of being a Nazi. But one of the kind of problems of our modernity is kind of grappling with this idea of extremist ideas that have been normalized, right? Extremist conspiracy theories that have been normalized and kind of are part of the discourse. And then the second thread going into this is education. So at my day job, as most of you know, I am kind of our unit's educator. I help bring up younger analysts, you know, really sharpen their technical skills. And then the podcast, again, is educational. We examine ideas, extremist ideas and ideologies. I have recently realized that outside job and podcast, most people don't want to take the phoner pill. They don't want to hear about Reconstruction or Free Men, Free Soil, or about Henry Louis Gates. It really just turns out that nobody wants to have those dry lectures. And so that problem I've been noodling on. How do you educate? How do you bring knowledge and truth to people, to an audience, to a lay audience that necessarily doesn't, they need it to be entertained as well as educated. So today, Andrew is going to help me kind of puzzle through those two things through the lens of Checkmate Lincolnites and being a film producer and kind of focusing on history. So with all that being said, please welcome Andrew. How's it going?
Hey, it's going well. I'm Andrew Rakic. I founded Attaché Films, Sina. Attaché Films is the pronunciation. Invites me onto his podcast, disrespects me to my face.
I'm so sorry.
No, I don't give a shit. But just, you know, if people want to find it, it's Attaché Films. I have a series called Checkmate Lincolnites, which is about dismantling the lost cause myth of the Confederacy, which, if you haven't heard of it, is basically a pro-Confederates, I guess you could call it a sort of trend of historiography, which began in Reconstruction and after the Civil War, spearheaded by ex-Confederates and then later their children, basically to paint the Confederate side of the Civil War in the best light possible. So, and I'm sure if you've never heard of the Lost Cause, I'm sure you've definitely heard some of the tenets of it, which is that slavery was not a major cause of the war, that the United States government at the time was tyrannical, or that the North was overbearing to the South. And you might have even heard that Lincoln was a tyrant, or that the war was about money or taxes. Mm-hmm. You might have heard that United States victory in the Civil War led to the oppressive centralized government we have now, and that that the Confederacy represented a libertarian strain of thought, a Jeffersonian strain of American political thought that we have not seen again because of their defeat in the Civil War. So essentially, basically, you will find the Confederacy whitewashed to the extent where many of their less savory attributes and less savory beliefs are conveniently swept under the rug. When in fact, every historian who knows what they're talking about will agree that the Civil War was fought almost entirely about slavery. The South seceded because they feared that slavery would be abolished. There's a lot of tenets to it. I go into a lot of detail in that series, but I believe that Sina invited me onto the podcast not because I'm so cute, but because I have a certain amount of of experience dealing with a very particular brand of extremist, namely the pro-Confederate, often very right-wing kind.
Yeah. So I'm kind of a sucker for an origin story, like the how and the why somebody comes to a subject. And like, I'm just curious, like, you know, how did you come to Checkmate Lincolnites? Like, what was that sort of decision making tree? Did you just kind of say like, hey, I'm going to, you know, go after the lost cause? Or like, I almost feel like you had a Union outfit and then like a Confederate outfit, and you're like, I got to make this work. But what, in your own sort of telling, what is the origin for Checkmate Lincolnites? Like,
yeah, well, I just had a bunch of those costumes lying around, and I have for decades, you know. So, I mean, a lot of those costumes I either got just in high school for like little movies that I made in the backyard, or Halloween, or whatever the fuck. Can I say fuck? Okay.
You're free to curse.
Okay, cool. You know, I just had them around, and then in the summer of 2013, I was a living historian at Gettysburg National Military Park for the 150th anniversary, and so I got a bunch of stuff for that too. So I just had a bunch of Civil War stuff lying around. So I did not really decide to, you know, Checkmate Lincolnites didn't start as a series. It started as a one-off thing that was just a comments response video, and that's basically what, for those of you who don't know, that's what Checkmate Lincolnites is it's a comment response series, right? So I am best known for my YouTube channel, and obviously, you know, YouTube comment sections are famously disgusting. It's like the stall of a men's room. And so basically I made a couple of Civil War videos that said a couple of things that are pretty uncontroversial in mainstream and academia, or really indeed in the minds of anyone who knows what they're talking about, which is that the, you know, Confederate States of America seceded to preserve slavery, and white supremacy was a huge deal, and these people were very committed to preserving it and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of people got very, very angry with me. And so I thought it would be funny. And my channel was small, you know, as of this recording, I've got like 260,000 subscribers, something like that. When I made the first Checkmate Lincolnites episode, it was, you know, again, not meant to be an episode. I had like maybe 900 subscribers. Like, I was a tiny, nothing little channel. And, but I got like some hate, comments for a video that I made about some local Confederate statues, where I live in New Orleans. And so I thought it would be kind of funny if a man in a Bill Compton foghorn leghorn accent read some of these insane comments. And it was pretty funny. And I kind of, I guess, sort of corrected some of the misconceptions in those early comments. But and so then people liked it. And so and as my channel grew, I kept getting hate mail and hate comments. So I figured, oh, you know, since people like it, I'll kind of keep it going. I'll make it a regular thing. As far as going after the lost cause, that was very much premeditated. Basically, when I was, I didn't start making YouTube videos to have a big YouTube channel. There are lots of people who do start YouTube channels with that in mind, and those YouTube channels are fucking creatively bankrupt. But I didn't start it with that in mind. I started it just like to give myself something to do, and to maybe have like, you know, just exercise myself creatively. And maybe that was sort of like, I was trying to break into, post-production, film post-production as an editor. And I figured if I had like a little body of work for YouTube that were well edited, that I might be able to like leverage it to like get a job. So that's kind of what I went in going, you know, what's sort of what I went in thinking that I was going to get out of Atunche Films. And, but basically what I kind of discovered is when I started doing local history stuff and some Civil War history, it occurred to me that that there really wasn't anybody doing that on YouTube, or even sort of publicly, who didn't, or there wasn't any public facing history sort of dismantling the Lost Cause systematically in a way. There were a couple people doing it, but frankly, they sounded like East Coast assholes. And as soon as you say the word heteronormative, you lose 60% of your audience. So I decided that I didn't want to do that. So I thought, you know what? Nobody's really doing this. The Lost Cause is frankly a very easy target. And I figured, you know what? I could probably, I think this would be, you know, something that would be cool to do, you know, that nobody else is doing. So that's kind of, I did sort of specifically decide, you know what, I'm going to go after the Lost Cause. And part of that was my own history with it. I was never a sort of, you know, huge right-wing guy or anything. I was also not from a Confederate descended family. I did not grow up in the South, though I have made my home here my entire adult life. But I did, mostly just kind of through sort of a, you know, kind of some sort of, I guess, teenage kind of more sort of libertarian, anti-authoritarian beliefs, which I still have, but I kind of mistakenly, believed, as many do, that the Confederacy kind of represented, as I said earlier, that kind of Jeffersonian libertarian strain of American thought. But I think, you know, as I've shown in a few of my videos, a close examination of the Confederate worldview examines that reveals that's not the case at all. But basically, that's kind of where I was coming from. So I sort of had, I felt like a little bit of cred, because I did actually used to believe a lot of this stuff when I was a teenager and a young adult. So I figured, okay, so I can kind of come at this from a place of understanding. I've kind of been there, and I sort of know where a lot of those people are coming from, and I'm not going to necessarily, you know, I'm sure a lot of my critics would disagree with this, but I'm not going to sort of go about it like somebody who's looking down on these people, you know what I mean? Or who thinks they're dumb. I'm going to just sort of like, you know, I'm going to go after this, but I'm going to try to, you know, speak the language of, I feel like, the people who maybe need to hear it most. So I didn't want to sort of go about it in a way that was purely advocacy, but there is certainly, like, I will fully admit that, like, there is a level of advocacy in the Checkmate Lincolnite series. Like, it is like trying to sell you something, right? It is trying to discredit one historiographic view and promote another. So that was, you know, I try to recognize my own biases as much as possible, and I try to be even-handed and relatively neutral within reason. Like, I'm not going to say, like, well, we should teach both sides of the Holocaust or whatever the sort of famous, you know, quote is. You know what I mean? But, like, I do try to sort of go about it in an even-handed way. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly, but it certainly came from that space, which was that, you know, this is probably something that could be really useful to people. And hopefully it is.
So as a producer, like, what was the decision? Why focus on the Civil War part of the Lost Cause? I think as we're, you know, as the Loopcast is kind of ramping up to do shows on Reconstruction, we, you know, you begin to see that strain of the Lost Cause kind of seep into the modern understanding of Reconstruction, right? You know, Foner and Du Bois kind of, you know, they're very much pushing back against the Lost Cause, right? You know, in the propaganda of history, Du Bois is saying, like, you know, the Dunning School is literally just taking the Lost Cause and making it polite. And then a lot of Foner's experience in writing the history of Reconstruction is pushing back against the Lost Cause.
Yeah.
So in your view as a producer, and, you know, you're writing out the script, you're doing the research, why, you know, focus on the Civil War and the Confederacy part of the Lost Cause, as opposed to its kind of expression during Reconstruction? Was it simply because the Civil War, everybody's kind of familiar with it, it's kind of big and dramatic and Ken Burnsy, or, you know, what is the sort of thought process, the creative thought process there?
Well, you know, the fat lady hasn't sung yet, Cena. There's still two more episodes left. So, you know, I won't confirm or deny anything, but let's just say the Reconstruction might pop up once or twice. But your point is taken. I mean, it is overwhelmingly the series is focused on this the years of the Civil War, right, 1860 to 1865, more so than the eighth episode is about states' rights, and that is essentially an account of the forging of the Confederate worldview. So it's that covers a lot of American history before the Civil War, right? So pretty much it goes from the American Revolution to the eve of secession, and it charts the Confederate worldview and how it developed. Now the Lost Cause, the development of the Lost Cause, is sort of another separate issue entirely, and that's very much tied up in Reconstruction and Jim Crow and beyond, you know, going into the 20th century, going into film history, and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't necessarily a conscious choice to just purely focus on the Civil War, but also your point is well taken, but it's also kind of another thing to kind of keep in mind about just what Checkmate Lincolnites ends up being. And this was kind of more true in the earlier rather than the later episodes, which are a lot more focused, but a big factor in what episodes I made, the topics of the episodes, was the comments that I got, right? It was sort of like, if I kind of saw a strain of comments about, like, well, you know, the Confederacy might have seceded for slavery, but nobody other than the really rich plantation owners cared about it. And if I get a bunch of those comments, then I'd be like, okay, well, that's not true. Like, a lot of normal people, white Southerners, even sort of rank and file poor yeoman farmers who were drafted as privates and corporals and grunts in the Confederate Army, like these, a lot of these people were very deeply invested in the preservation of slavery, and more, even more importantly, the white supremacy and the social order and the social stability that slavery represented as an institution. And so I could make an episode about that, you know, or a lot of people saying, you know, that Sherman raped and murdered more people than, you know, Hitler and Genghis Khan combined. And obviously that's nonsense, but there's also kind of some truth to that, right? So, like, you know, Sherman was not a good guy. So, like, how, let's explore that, you know? So, so that was kind of more sort of what dictated it, I guess. But if I could do it over again, and if I knew ahead of time that I had, you know, a limited series to discredit the entire Lost Cause, I probably would have gone about it a bit differently. I probably would have had at least one or two more Reconstruction focused episodes. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I didn't even know that it was going to be a series at first, right? So you know, and that kind of goes into the film producer part too, which you mentioned is, you know, a lot of just shows, whether they be on, you know, TV or YouTube or fictional or documentary, they kind of like usually take a couple episodes or maybe even a couple seasons to like find their feet, you know, and to kind of like figure out what they are. And that was very much the case with Checkmate too, was it. I would probably go about it a little bit differently and talk a lot more about Reconstruction, because you're right. I mean, it is, and forgive me if I'm putting words into your mouth here, Sina, but it is kind of a very forgotten element, right? It's a part of American history that we'd all kind of rather forget, because it was so awful, because it was so, it really lay bare all of the issues that led to the Civil War and that pervaded the Civil War, all these messy, horrible racial issues and the fallout from the abolition of slavery. Like, it wasn't an easy transition, right? The birth of freedom, the labor was long of the birth of freedom, right? It's definitely I have a buddy who calls it intentionally induced amnesia, and that's very much the case with Reconstruction.
I mean, I think that's your series does kind of fights back against that amnesia, because I think for me, like the hour long show on the debate of states' rights, like, was it about states' rights or was it about slavery? And which kind of like really took me back, was that the Confederacy, like, it almost seems like when you're going through like AP history, that it seems like the Confederacy kind of just materialized, right? It just kind of happened, right? We're gonna, you know, create this governmental order to protect slavery, but then you kind of in Checkmate, you kind of dig through their own words and their own kind of documents and their own kind of conceptions. And I was like, huh, right? Like you kind of tackle the problem of intentional amnesia with their own words. And it was just so fascinating to me that like the fighting back of amnesia and the fighting back of kind of the erasure of the Confederacy's own ideology and its own thinking was kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, this stuff was very long coming. I mean, for, you know, nearly a century, I mean, shit, more than a century, you know, going back to the 17th century, going back to the early colonial period, you know, the Confederacy did not come out of nowhere. And you know, and looking back and examining the history of Southern slavery and the history of the federal government's, you know, sort of complicity in slavery and its support of the institution, it's really no wonder that the country fell apart for the reasons it did and when it did. Basically, when a president who was widely believed to be abolitionist, even though he wasn't, was elected, right? That would be enough to dissolve the Union. It's in retrospect, it's really not surprising at all. And oftentimes this idea that while this was certainly the case on an individual basis, in some cases, the idea that the South kind of reluctantly parted from the Union because they just couldn't go the way that it was going is nonsense. Like they enthusiastically seceded because of a deep and, as it turned out, you know, kind of justified fear that that the central, you know, that the greatest law of the land, that the federal government, was going to turn hard against slavery and start telling rather than asking. The development of the Confederate worldview is fascinating. I mean, this stuff goes back, you know, I mean, the Mexican War is something that I didn't really touch on in that episode that I wish I had, but, you know, that's kind of like, how long did we want that video to be? You know, it was already an hour. But yeah, I mean, a lot of that stuff, you know, Andrew Jackson was an enormous part of, and Jacksonian democracy, an enormous part of the Confederate worldview, and specifically its white supremacy, and how that was understood in the context of limited government. That I think is very, very interesting stuff. There's a lot of protein there as far as understanding the Confederates and where they were coming from and the political tradition that they came from. Yeah.
I think for me, your video series really got me thinking about kind of the idea of anti-slavery versus abolition. And the reason I bring that up is because when thinking about extremism, like, it's really easy to say, okay, white supremacy in its form, in any form, is an extremist, right? And we can say the Confederacy is clearly an extremist government. It wouldn't, you know, you don't have to twist yourself up in knots to kind of make that argument. And then I started thinking about, well, Lincoln, he wasn't this John Brown level abolitionist. He could be categorized as anti-slavery. Yeah. And then I started thinking, okay, how do I divide anti-slavery versus abolition? And then that became kind of this other avenue of historical exploration, like, oh, right. Even the belief that, you know, we agree with, anti-slavery, exists on a spectrum, historically on the spectrum of, you know, a reasonable position versus John Brown. Yeah. I mean, even like John Brown is kind of, people see him as a hero, but.
Yeah, but they sure as shit didn't back then. I mean, many didn't, but as the Civil War progressed, they did, because, you know, the amount of bloodshed the Civil War, you know, caused was I mean, John Brown was a drop in the bucket compared to that. But I mean, yeah, the difference between an anti-slavery, somebody who was anti-slavery and somebody who was an abolitionist was the difference between somebody who does Meatless Mondays every once in a while and a Animal Liberation Front terrorist who, you know, blows up the offices of Tyson Chicken. You know what I mean? Like, that's the difference. It's a matter of degrees and of extremity. And while abolitionists weren't, you know, we think of them today as the good guys. And I think that's a fair assessment in talking broad strokes. Obviously, the individuals involved in the abolitionist movement, a lot of the prominent ones were quite problematic themselves in many ways, you know, whether it be their anti-Semitism or some of their anti-Catholicism or, you know, or just plain racism, right? It was just they maybe, you know, even some of the abolitionists who were as anti-slavery as they came still didn't think that, you know, Black people were on the level of white people. They just didn't, you know. But yeah, I mean, that's certainly, I mean, talk about extremism, like those people were extreme for their time. The reformers, you know, the naysayers, the people who wouldn't go along. Yeah, anti-slavery was in many ways a position that that apologized for the practice in a lot of ways, and certainly regarded the feelings and the economic prosperity of the prosperity and the dignity of slave owners to be of greater importance than the immediate welfare of their slaves. So put that in your pipe and fucking smoke it. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting to think about. I mean, I'm very glad that we have come as far as we have.
Well, I mean, I bring it up because the lost, like it seems like the abolitionist movement kind of evolves. You know, goes. You know, they pass the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, then it kind of drops off. You know, until the civil rights movement, right? Until the 50s, the 60s, until you have this kind of taking of the abolition movement of its natural kind of evolution and, you know, having it express itself as the civil rights, equal rights movement. But yet the lost cause kept on persisting. I'm such at a loss. Like, why? Like, part of me is like, oh, there's always going to be reactionary white people. There's always going to be white folks that take issue with the liberation and political empowerment of Blacks. But then, the historian in me was like, that's too simple, right? The persistent, like, why the lost cause persists through today, through 2022, when you as a producer answering the comment section in your videos, like, straight up lost causers. But, like, why is the lost cause such a persistent myth in your view?
I don't think it's necessarily is that surprising. I mean, first of all, the men and women who propagated the lost cause after the Civil War were very effective advocates and activists. You had groups like the United Confederate Veterans, who would later kind of evolve in a roundabout way to the Sons of Confederate Veterans, who are still active today. The United Daughters of the Confederacy is another famous group that is still around today, although their influence is greatly diminished. These were veterans organizations that were not only about commemoration, but they were about propagation of what they saw as the truth of history, what they would have viewed as the Southern side of history. Now, this is an important distinction to be made. This is a mistake that that a lot of people, a lot of people make this mistake, which is the lost cause is not simply the Southern side of history. There is a big difference between a historical misconception and a historical perspective, right? So, like, again, kind of going with the idea of like, this is a bit of a crude comparison and certainly an obvious one, but, you know, kind of what I was saying earlier with that meme you see a lot, which is, you know, let's teach both sides of the Holocaust, you know, which is sort of kind of used to make fun of people who are so obsessed with including every perspective that they include just these that you just irresponsibly include these very hateful ones, right? So like, and that's very much the case of this, is that like, you can't, like, there is not a legitimate side to history of the Holocaust that is, you know, well, there was this international Jewish cabal and they had to be, you know, something needed to be done about them. Like, that's not a legitimate interpretation of history, right? That is like false, that was not going on. So if you wanted to tell the story of the Holocaust from the National Socialist point of view, you would basically say, well, they thought this and you know, but it wouldn't make them, even if it was from their point of view, they wouldn't seem any less monstrous. And that is unfortunately the case with the Confederacy as well, right? Like saying, well, they just cared about their liberty and they didn't want to be unfairly taxed and they just wanted states' rights. Like that's not what happened, right? That is like factually incorrect. It is demonstrably wrong. They seceded because they wanted to keep slavery and they said so often and loudly. So if you were to tell the, and this is often a big part of what I do, and especially kind of my non-Checkmate Lincolnites related videos, especially about sort of Confederate figures or movements, I often say like, well, you know, they did this because they wanted to uphold the system of white supremacy or whatever. And that is their side of the story, right? That was their motivation. Self-admittedly their motivation, right? So you can tell their side of the story, that's fine, but like they're still not gonna come out well by our modern standards. So that kind of makes the Lost Cause necessary, right? In order to commemorate them. And so in that, the Lost Cause has evolved to keep step with modern morality. Right. So and the changing customs and mores of American culture, because at first the Lost Cause was not did not deny that slavery had played a part in the Civil War, but it apologized for slavery. Right. It said no, slavery was good, actually. And then within a decade or two after the war, people started saying, well, no, slavery had very little to do with it. Or they'll say, well, yeah, I mean, the issue on the surface might have been slavery, but there was so much else that you know, that the South just couldn't submit to, you know, that it would have been dishonorable for them to submit to. And so at that point, slavery was done. The slaves had been freed and the world hadn't fallen apart. And in fact, once Jim Crow and legal segregation came around, especially after 1894 and the Plessy versus Ferguson, a lot of white Southerners, either former Confederates or their children, came to accept segregation as a effective substitute for slavery as a tool to control the black underclass. So at that point, because the world didn't fall apart and because actually the white South kind of didn't, it turned out pretty well, right? Like it didn't, It was economically devastated, but socially they were able to maintain an equilibrium. And so, yeah, what kind of started off as a method to sort of save face and to improve their legacy kind of turned into political advocacy, namely for white supremacist causes. I mean, the United Daughters of the Confederacy in particular was very insistent on getting Southern histories in Southern schools, often written by ex-Confederates that were pretty shamelessly biased toward them, and that painted them in a great light. So, right, so this kind of all helped them maintain that kind of cultural equilibrium and that social equilibrium that maintained white supremacy. So going into the 20th century, right, like then the Lost Cause kind of changed again. It changed with the civil rights movement, you know, and after it became socially irresponsible to just be openly racist in most quarters, the Lost Cause that you saw started to see things like the Black Confederate myth, which we talked about on Checkmate Lincolnites, drawing a lot from the research of this guy named Kevin Levin. Who wrote a great book on the topic called Searching for Black Confederates, among others. And then the Black Confederate thing, basically that I'm sure probably many people who listening have heard it, that it basically maintains that Black people fought in the Confederate Army and white Southerners and Black Southerners fought side by side. Nothing of the case happened except in very isolated instances, as far as we can tell, when camp slaves picked up guns in extreme circumstances, right? So that kind of has another element to it, right? Where it's like the Black Confederate thing, originating as it did mostly in the 1970s, was basically an idea to get the Confederacy right on race relations retrospectively, right? So it was like the North didn't care about Black people, we did. And you know, you see that today. I mean, there's the Sons of Confederate Veterans has a promotional video that is on YouTube that shows like a bunch of members of the organization, and a rabbi is very prominently portrayed. You know, look at us, we can't be racist, we have a Jewish guy. You know, that that's very much a part of it nowadays, right? Is you know, because increasingly and more so, especially now in the 2020s, now that open racism is becoming deeply socially unacceptable, they've found other ways to get the Confederacy right on it. And so that basically has, its adaptability has contributed to its staying power.
So something that I kind of find interesting is kind of the cult of personality that occurs in the Lost Cause. For instance, the veneration of Lee, the veneration of Stonewall Jackson, and then kind of the editing of history of ignoring James Longstreet. I think the book I have somewhere in my pile, it's about him during Reconstruction, being in, I think it's in Louisiana, New Orleans, where he's the head of a militia fighting against white supremacists, but that's besides the point.
No, that very much is the point.
Oh, okay. I mean, the Lost Cause, they just edited him out. Like, he's not there. Like, you just kind of have to, like, where's Longstreet?
Yeah. Well, he is. I mean, well, he is, but he's a pariah. You know, he's there's a great book by Charles Reagan Wilson, I think is the author's name, called Baptized in Blood, which examines the Lost Cause through a religious lens, and makes a pretty convincing argument that that the way that that the catechisms, rituals, and ceremonies of post-war Confederate commemoration, it had a very explicitly religious, dogmatic tenor to it, and you had figures, like you said, venerated, like Lee and Jackson. Lee having, you know, being this kind of like perfect angelic form with no faults. In many ways, he's seen as the perfect Christian man. He's very much Christ figure. Jackson as kind of the sort of wild-eyed warrior, is very much like Moses, and Longstreet is like Judas. You know, he's the betrayer. He's the scalawag, the one who wouldn't who gave Lee up and betrayed Lee. Which, to be fair, he totally did. you know, by basically publicly insulting him. Longstreet wasn't a terribly tactful guy. And he criticized Lee publicly after the war, and he was right in his criticisms, but he was pretty tactless in the way that he went about it. And he opened himself up to a lot of criticism from people like Jubal Early and William Nelson Pendleton, who were former Confederate officers, high-level Confederate officers who went on to become historians. Who savaged him mercilessly in print. So he's very much kind of the Judas. But anyway, so he basically became a Republican after the Civil War. Of course, back then, the Democrats were the racist ones. and the Republicans were the slightly less racist ones. And so he became a Republican. He had been a very good friend of Ulysses S. Grant before the war, and after Grant became president, he maintained that friendship and took a government post. I believe he was he was in charge of customs in the port of New Orleans, and New Orleans was a very important port back then, so it was a big job. But basically, he was a government worker here in New Orleans, and in 1874. When the gubernatorial election of 1872 was contested, there was a big battle here in the street, basically, when ex-Confederates forming a white supremacist paramilitary group called the White League tried to take over and briefly succeeded in taking over the state government by force. You know, they, like 3,000 of them came down the street with guns and killed a bunch of people and fought the police with guns and stormed the state house. We were the capital of Louisiana back then. So basically Longstreet led the police force that fought them. Right. So, and that did not win him any friends in the South. So he wasn't edited out, but he was reviled, and a lot of his actual achievements during the Civil War were either downplayed or conveniently ignored, or, you know, and a lot of things were pinned on him, most famously the losing of the Battle of Gettysburg, that were not really his fault at all, or at least, you know, partially his fault, kind of. But he caught a lot of shit for it that he did not deserve. Interestingly, though, even as he was getting savaged by Lost Cause historians and by former Confederate officers, the rank and file Confederate soldiers who were, you know, fucking not Republican, they were very anti-Reconstructionist, but they still, even there with their political differences, his men, like his common soldiers who had fought under him, still loved him, and they loved him until he died. So I always thought that was very interesting. Little tidbit that, you know, even though he was this huge pariah, he was still like warmly welcomed at a lot of veterans events. It was just kind of the upper echelon, right? Sort of the cronies of Lee and the evangelists of the Lost Cause who gave Longstreet an awful reputation that has endured in a huge way. Like a lot of this stuff was most of the 20th century. Even like well-done Civil War histories were very anti-Longstreet. and it was all fabrications, right? It was all just like lies and distortions.
So I want to maybe switch footing from the Lost Cause to Checkmate Lincolnites, and specifically the character of Johnny Reb. And what I really like about this is that I didn't realize it. Like initially when I was listening to the series, I would listen to it in the car, and I would never actually look at the screen. I would just
fucking breaking my heart, dude.
I would be driving, right?
And then, I put so much effort into the lighting, design. Effort into the cinematography. And then motherfuckers like Cena listen to it in the fucking car. Jesus Christ.
Then upon the second second run through of Checkmate Lincolnites, I realized that the Johnny Reb character, his lines were, you weren't writing them, they were actually real comments. Is that right?
Yeah.
So in terms of you engaging the audience, like, I mean, can you talk about that a bit? Like the formation of Johnny Reb and sort of, you know, is he kind of a stand-in for the audience, a stand-in for the comment section? Like, how do we think about his character?
Yeah, well, it's a very old format, right? It's a dialogue. It's Socratic, right? I mean, this is a... I mean, I trust me, I'm aware of how pretentious this sounds, but here's a little secret. I went to art school. I'm a pretentious guy. Fuck it. I own it. But it's a Socratic dialogue, right? This is an ancient form of education, right? It is an ancient form of that all sorts of shit has been framed in. And that's what it is, right? It's a framing device. A lot of people call Checkmate Lincolnites like a debate series. It is not a debate series, right? And a lot of very galaxy-brained individuals like to call Johnny Reb a straw man, referring to a common logical fallacy, where basically, in order to defeat an argument, you misrepresent its points, right? So you're knocking down a straw man. Johnny Reb is not a straw man, and the fact that materials presented in a dialogue has nothing to do with that, right? It's just comments, response. And also, I don't think I am misrepresenting their argument. Like, people who say that are always like, oh, you know, he's like, if only I were there in the room with him, I would be able to like tell him what's what. It's like, all right, man, like, please direct me to the to this cogent, intelligent, and well-sourced defense of the lost cause. Like, because I've looked all over and I ain't fucking find it. I ain't fucking found it, right? Seriously, there's just no, like, this is what these people believe, right? This is not like a crazy caricature. It is not like these are their words, and the way that I present it is not like that far-fetched, right? I don't like put my thumb on the scale. This is the stuff that's widely believed, right? Basically it's a dialogue, and Johnny Reb it's a common response video, right? So like, it is I could do the same series with just me on camera reading comments off my phone and responding to them, right? But that just wouldn't be as much fun. So I do it the way that I do it. So basically, rather famously in our little niche, in our little world, Johnny Reb has undergone a bit of a metamorphosis. He used to be just a fucking piece of shit and a huge racist and a gigantic asshole. He's still an asshole, but more of a lovable one now. He's portrayed a bit more as he's a bit more buffoonish, right? He's not a bad guy. He just has some wrong ideas that the character of Billy Yank then sort of corrects. And I think this is, and I kind of made this change because this is a much more accurate portrayal of a lot of people who believe this stuff, right? They're not monsters. They're not. Most of them aren't even that racist, considering the sort of racially charged and politically charged kind of subject matter, right? They just have been taught this stuff their whole lives. Maybe they have an ideological dog in the fight, right? Like I said, I mean, a lot of people come to the lost cause through libertarianism. There's a bit of a pipeline there where people have a healthy distrust of the government. So they look to American history and they find the only instance where people actually semi-successfully rebelled against the government. And they kind of fetishize it a little bit, or they kind of pick and choose the bits of the Confederate philosophy that kind of fit into that, while forgetting that if you weren't like a white male, how unbelievably awful this, a Christian white male, I should say, how unbelievably awful this system would have been for you. So he represents that, right? He's Johnny Reb is everybody's drunk uncle. He's everybody's, you know, libertarian dad or whatever. And you know, he's not an idiot. He's just a bit of a fool, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I mean, what I like about it, where like really kind of has put me on the Checkmate Lincolnites hype train, is that so much of our historical education is, as you kind of pointed out, is just like somebody at the lectern lecturing, right? like YouTube, you can go on YouTube right now and, you know, go through 20 hours of Foner, of Blight, of, you know, Gates, right? You can literally give yourself a graduate level education in Reconstruction, in the Lost Cause. But
yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. But like, none of them are responding. They're not like arguing or discussing, right? There, it's always, even with like Henry Louis Gates, who's very much, you know, he's very engaging. He's very much, he understands media. It's still like, it's always through his prism, through his lens. He's never in conversation and in argument. Whereas like with the character of Johnny Reb, I think it's just so cool how you're just kind of, you know, setting it up and you're in discussion with him. I mean, obviously, if for the audience that's listening to the podcast, it's played by you, but it's, you know, you as Johnny Reb. But, you know, in terms of historical education and educating and making a point, you know, was that kind of why you had the Johnny Reb character, or was it just like, you know, I want to play a Southerner, this like goofball, you know, Foghorn Leghorn type of guy, and I think it would just be a fun character to play. Like, what was sort of the educational and the sort of communication aspect of it?
I mean, that's kind of, I feel like that's my whole shtick in a big way, is kind of the entertainment and education. I mean, I attempt to deliver a higher quality of and more kind of like advanced level of information for the format in which I do it, which is quite sort of infotainment-y. You know, I mean, my stuff is I try to keep it as up to date as possible. I draw from, and there's a bit of a learning curve on this, but you know, these days I draw almost exclusively from academic sources. And if they're not academic, then I at least try to, I at least make sure that they are in fact reputable. So, you know, it's, you know, so yeah, so that's, I guess the thing with Johnny Reb is, I guess to go back to your point, is, so I played a character very much like that in, when I, worked at Gettysburg, right? So, just to clarify, and I think you might've said at the beginning that I was a reenactor. Now that's not entirely true. You know, reenacting is when it's a hobby and you get your gear and you go out on the weekends and you do battle reenactments and stuff like that, or you do living history events. Like I did not do that, but I was a living historian kind of tour guide person, which basically meant that I was an actor, right? I did this sort of theatrical kind of performance thing, and it was a bit lame, but it was fun. At least when me and my buddy did it, we made it pretty fun. Where we would basically play soldiers from the Civil War, and we'd take, you know, you and your kids and your grandma across the battlefield and talk about what happened to us. And a lot of times we'd draw from, you know, actual sources and diaries of the battle and all that kind of stuff. And you know, obviously I wasn't really talking about anything too controversial. A lot of it was just, oh my God, how brave those soldiers, they were so brave. But you know, I did, it wasn't as exaggerated as the one in Checkmate Lincolnites, but I did a very old timey Southern accent, and, you know, and my buddy and I, who I did that job with, you know, we would just be like, yeah, fucking getting ice cream and be like, I have the Rocky Road, you know, and shit like that. And then we'd go by General Pickett's buffet by the McDonald's in Gettysburg and say, but General Pickett, what do you see? I see a place where I will one day have a buffet named in my honor, where there will be creamed corn. Like, you know, we kind of played it for laughs and shit just from ourselves. But, you know, and we were like in character a lot, you know, so, and it was just fun doing the Southern accent and doing kind of that, you know, like there are these Civil War movies, directed by this guy named Ron Maxwell called, Gettysburg and Gods and Generals, and Gettysburg is pretty good. Gods and Generals is not very good, But it has a lot of that kind of stuff in it, of these very, very, very sincere Southern generals talking about all the men who have died and how awful it is to be at war. And, you know, and it's just like fucking stupid and silly and ridiculous and just so overwrought and sentimental. But that was kind of like a funny kind of thing to like joke around with my buddy, you know. And then so when I did Checkmate Lincolnites, I fell very easily into that. That kind of a character, because like we had just gone around Gettysburg, you know, smoking doobies and talking to each other in that voice, you know. So so yeah, that was very easy. Yeah, I mean, I think for the as far as like a entertainment aspect of it, I mean, yeah, I think like, you know, just a little bit of chocolate helps the pill go down, you know what I mean? Like yeah, I mean, you can, a lot of academics do not have, you know, I mean, look, like when academics are writing, are writing history, they're writing for each other, right? They're writing to impress each other. They're not writing for the public, not most of them. And if they are, they're like more concerned what their colleagues will think than what the public will think. Like they, you know, they're a fucking catty bunch. Historians, right? And they, and you know, and you said, well, you know, sort of some of the people like Eric Foner doesn't like respond to anybody, like maybe not directly and maybe not like in a lecture publicly, but like in books, fuck yeah, he does. Like, you know, and in a super bitchy way too. Like historians will be like, this guy doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. Like this lady is wrong. Like this lady, you know, her sources are out of date. Like she's reliant on this source, which is like compromised, because, you know, they're constantly ripping each other to pieces. And so when you are, and that's good, right? I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Like that's just how history works, right? That's peer review, is you're supposed to kind of try to poke holes in other historians, especially historians that have come before you, in order to come to a more complete understanding of the event. Now, I'm not going to say that no historian has ever kind of gone after somebody else for personal gain or for career advancement. Like that definitely happens, but ultimately, right, it's like science, right? You like challenge previously held assumptions in order to come to more accurate conclusions or to make breakthroughs in your field, right? It's the same principle. So I will say they like do, they definitely respond to each other, and they definitely are in kind of debate and in conversation, and in they respond to each other, right? But like, but yeah, I mean, your point is very well taken, just in the idea that like a lot of the stuff just is not terribly palatable for normal people. And that's a big part of what I do. Like a lot of, I mean, sometimes in my videos, I'll kind of sort of stick my toe into the water a little bit and kind of venture a hypothesis that is my own and that is not, you know, and just say, well, here's kind of my take. Here's what I think. Here's my interpretation and my analysis of this. But specifically for Checkmate Lincolnites, because it's so popular and because also the ground has been covered so thoroughly and so well by other historians like Eric Foner, like Gary Gallagher, you know, that I don't, you know, I'm pretty conservative in Checkmate Lincolnites, right? I stick pretty tightly to modern academic consensus. Very little of what I've said, you know, Charles Royster and Gary Gallagher and all those guys haven't said, but it is the presentation, right? Like that's the whole idea, is that the presentation is modern. The presentation is comedic. It's, you know, I hope it, you know, it has sort of little in jokes for people who are obsessed with the Civil War and who know a lot about it, but also you could go into it knowing nothing about the Civil War, maybe even vaguely heard, oh yeah, I kind of heard that Civil War was fought over states' rights and slavery, but, and I knew there was a debate about that, but I wasn't quite sure about it. You could like watch it and you could be like, get a lot out of it. So yeah, I mean, that's what I strive to do, hopefully, with a lot of my stuff, is just like deliver high quality information better than most infotainment does, which let's face it, is very shoddily produced and often just thrown together to make a buck. Million YouTube channels like that, that are just summaries of Wikipedia articles with fucking cartoon balls or whatever the fuck. You know, so basically what I try to do is I try to do the entertaining thing and make people laugh or make people, you know, cry or whatever. I want to emotionally engage them, but I also want to deliver high quality information. You know, and hopefully I do that. But yeah, I don't know. I hope that answers your question. Before we started, you were like, so we don't cut out rambling. I hope you're okay with that. I'm just like, oh, what the fuck? Just going on for 5 minutes about nothing.
No, it's okay. Like, I think you're kind of not downplaying, but I think like entertainment really plays a strong role in how we understand history, because right now I'm digging into the emergence of the second Klan in the beginning of the 20th century. And then a lot of historians, they point to, you know, the birth of the second Klan was based on Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffin. Okay, what is Birth of a Nation about? Well, it's about Reconstruction. And it's like, huh. So his kind of 4-hour slogfest about Reconstruction is what kind of fueled the resurgence of the second Klan. And then I think about my previous readings with Foner and with Du Bois, right? And they're writing hundreds of pages, dense history of pushing back, right? Pushing back against the Lost Cause, against the Dunning School. And in some ways, you know, they're only writing, Foner is kind of, his first audience is fellow historians. His second audience is the public. Du Bois, you know, he doesn't even have a resurgence until the 60s and 70s, until, you know, pretty much at the end of his life.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious, like, when you as a director, as a producer, as a historian, sit back and think about the value of entertainment in history, how do you conceptualize that? Like, do we need like a Ken Burnsing of Reconstruction? Do we need like, how do we sort of, you know, bring history to the masses in sort of a good and informative sort of way?
Yeah. Well, I'm trying my best, but I'll get back to you. I guess I'll get back to you on that, guy. I don't, I'm giving my best shot, but I don't know even what I'm doing is working. So as far as like Birth of a Nation though, I mean, that's very true. I mean, I mentioned the film Gettysburg, you know, which spawned a whole generation of Civil War reenactors who to this day at public events will teach a version of Civil War history more inspired by the movie than by evidence. And so there's and there remains which hopefully, you know, Checkmate Lincolnites helps bridge the gap in its kind of small, limited way, but there remains a pretty substantial disconnect between academic consensus, which has been the academic consensus for as long as I've been alive, and the perception of the public at large and the perception of the, you know, you can't see me, but I'm doing huge fucking air quotes, Civil War experts, Civil War buffs, who are, you know, your fucking dad at a barbecue, who, you know, he's a great guy, I'm sure, but your dad doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. Like, truly, your dad is kind of a fucking moron and doesn't know the first thing about the Civil War. He just doesn't. He's very sweet. I'm sure he's a great guy, but he doesn't know what he's talking about. So, you know, he's seen 3 movies and read a couple books that are wildly out of date. And that goes for the Ken Burns thing as well. Now the Ken Burns documentary isn't bad, but it is, over-reliant on Shelby Foote, whose understanding of the Civil War was dated. He's not the worst offender of Civil War historiography by any means, but he was a storyteller and a novelist, not a historian. And though he knew quite a bit about many aspects of the Civil War, his historiography was out of date by the 90s when that movie was made. So, you know, it remains a pretty flawed sort of understanding. And yeah, a lot of these, you know, Gettysburg, Birth of a Nation, Gods and Generals, Gone with the Wind, my God, Gone with the Wind, Ken Burns' Civil War, lots of this stuff had a profound impact on people's understanding of the Civil War. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you said kind of from the perspective of a filmmaker, sort of, you know, yeah, kind of what I thought about that. And yeah, I mean, that's 100% true. I mean, these things had a huge impact on just popular understanding and pop culture. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this stuff kind of remains to be undone. The damage remains to be undone. And yeah, I mean, Birth of the Nation is kind of the cardinal example of that, you know, first blockbuster, huge ideological impact that threw the United States back, you know, arguably generations, you know, although I think it was kind of a perfect storm, right? Sort of, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson was kind of the eye of that storm, and Birth of a Nation was one of its, you know, many sort of bands standing out. But yeah, I mean, yeah, this stuff has a huge impact. And hopefully, again, hopefully in its small, limited way, Checkmate Lincolnites also has an impact in that regard, to kind of course correct away from all this baggage and this madness of the Lost Cause.
Absolutely. So I think we've come to the fun part of the show. So this part of the show is kind of inspired by, during a Q&A, somebody asked Eric Foner, what did he think of Team of Rivals, the movie? And then he was like, it's okay. And then somebody asked, compared to Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer. And he was like, you know, they're kind of both the same. They're both kind of works of fiction. I like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer a little more. So that got us thinking. And we got lucky when you agreed to be on the show. We said, you know, Andrew is this esteemed filmmaker. He has a lot of experience, you know, writing scripts, producing. So what we want to do for this next part of the show is I want to pitch you some some movies, series based on history.
Okay.
And so here we go. So have you know Hamilton, right? The musical?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you're aware of the Wu-Tang Clan biopic on Hulu. Or the NWA biopic that came out a few years ago.
Yeah.
So in my first pitch to you is Reconstruction, the hip hop musical. So it's about the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And it focuses on Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, and then Lyman Turnbull. So it would be Thad the Chad, Chucky Sums, and L the Big Bull. And it would be kind of very much in the style of Hamilton, where it would be, there would be hip hop, but about the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th.
Well, Amendments. You know, the trouble with that is that I've seen that movie. It's called Lincoln. It was directed by Steven Spielberg. and you're just adding hip hop to it. So if you're going to, I legitimately think that like that's, that like a hip hop musical about Reconstruction. And I know you're kind of joking around, but I'm not. It would either be the most tasteless, awful thing ever and the most horrible bullshit, just like offensive on every level, or it would be the fucking dopest, most poignant thing you've ever seen that would win Pulitzer prizes. And but the thing is, you couldn't make it about Thaddeus Stevens or any of those pasty old white guys. It would have to be about black people in Alabama or something. It would have to be about like a family on a farm who got 40 acres and a mule.
Okay.
And so, it's just about them and over the course of their lives, and they have awful lives, and it ends in horrible tragedy.
Oh my God. For them.
And you know, at the end, you know, and you know, like the young daughter who's like 4 years old, when in the 1870s, when the stuff thing is taking place, you know, then it flashes to her in like the 50s, and like some white dude is still making her give up her seat, you know, and And she's an old lady and she's still being horribly abused. And it would have to just have no hope whatsoever and just be like the most depressing shit you've ever seen. That would win a Pulitzer Prize.
I was really just hoping for a Hamilton style because.
Well, welcome to my brain.
No, that's, I mean, that's good because the reason I mentioned Hamilton is because like a lot of my normie non-history white friends are into Hamilton. I think to myself, man, you know, what a great way to educate people, drop a hip hop album and make a little shmoney, a little money as the kids.
Yeah,
call it.
Totally.
Okay.
It'll always be the poor man's 1776.
My second pitch.
Okay.
So in one of your streams, you talked about how you kind of liked Prey, right? The Predator movie with the Comanche, with the Comanche, the young lady who kills the Predator thing.
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was fun.
So I want to pitch Prey 2. It's set during Reconstruction. It gets so much worse. So the movie opens up with Grant and Sherman versus the Predator. Then Grant, Sherman, the Predator versus the Klan. And then
I was going to say that's obvious. That's obviously where it would have to go. Yeah.
And then the movie ends with Grant and Sherman versus the Predator again. So.
No, they would have to respect each other at the end. They would be like, they'd be looking at each other from across the field and the Predator would just like nod.
Thumbs up.
Yeah. and you know, yeah, exactly. They would have to be on the same side at the end and work together. I do think the Predator versus the Klan would be pretty awesome. And it would, you know, and the Predator would be a good guy like he was in Alien versus Predator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think Alien versus the Klan might be a little bit more fun though, but I don't know. Honestly, I don't hate that idea. I don't hate that idea at all. I do think, I don't think Grant and Sherman should be in it. I think it should just be like the Klan and just, it's just a slasher movie, right? It's literally just like, how it's fun and we're waiting for the next kill so we can all cheer and it's just Klansmen dying in unspeakable ways, just like super over the top gore. That's the one context you can get away with that kind of gore,
is killing Klansmen,
is if it's a Klansman, and then you can rip his penis off and you'd get a G rating because families need to see it. That's what America needs, is G-rated castration of Klansmen.
So my third pitch, which is just as cringy and tasteless as the first two.
Okay.
Have you heard of the movie Inglourious Basterds?
Yes, I have.
And you know Harriet Tubman?
Yes.
Okay. So it's her leading the, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the Combahee River Raid? Combahee?
I don't know how it's pronounced either.
So it would be that, but it's kind of like an Inglourious Basterds, where she's like chomping on a cigar and she's like, you owe me 100 Confederate scalps or whatever. Like I haven't really scripted this out. I thought it would just be kind of cool to, you know, just have Harriet Tubman in a spy action movie. You know, I think
that would be pretty badass. I think there is a movie like that, and it's not Django. It's there's a movie called, you know, Harriet or something that came out. I didn't fucking see it and looked fucking stupid, but like it was, but it's kind of a feel good, like watch racists get shot type of movie. It came out like 3 years ago or something, where Harriet Tubman is like hot and, you know, shotgun. But it kind of built itself. I mean, it just looked very, you know, it looked kind of silly, but like it did like market itself as like this, you know, super meaningful, like important movie about like important issues. And like Harriet Tubman was just like a supermodel with a fucking like AK, you know what I mean? It's just like, not an AK, but like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was a scene with her and a Gatling gun, you know, Like it was just like action movie schlock, but like, you know, the incredible true story. So I'm pretty sure there is a movie kind of like that. I think Harriet Tubman, I mean, Harriet Tubman was fucking badass and she was awesome. And I don't want to take anything away from Harriet Tubman here, but I do think that there are like other Black abolitionists who should maybe get a little more love in the movies and just in history that, you know, who were just like unrepentantly violent from the start and, and just like, we're just like, I'm just going to fucking like, if somebody like after the Fugitive Slave Act, like the people who are just like, I'm just going to, if they come after me, I'm just going to fucking like open fire, you know? Yeah, that shit was cool. I want to see a little more of that.
I mean, I think, I'm not muted. I think there is an audience for that. I think like, I think it was
Ethan Hawke did a John Brown.
Yeah. He did, and the show ended up kind of being like the book and the show are kind of goofy and funny. Like it's just weird. Like they portray John Brown as kind of funny, but he's like this hyper violent dude, but he's like, and then you could always team up like historical figures with the Predator, and then
you could always do that.
Always. I think Prey just kind of opened the door for me for weird, cringy thoughts about like Predator in various historical settings.
I don't think it's cringy. I don't think it's cringy at all. I think it's cool. I think that'd be cool. I mean, I think like, I do really like sort of historical sci-fi and horror. That does kind of tickle me in a special place. That shit is fun. I really like that kind of stuff. I would give you pitches, but you know, God willing, maybe I'll make some of my pitches one day and I don't want to necessarily, you know, just have it out there in the world. I love that kind of shit. And I regularly write fucking, what if vampires were in the Revolutionary War type of shit all the time. And it's good and it's awesome. I mean, you know, my favorite movie is Ravenous. So, you know, I think that kind of says it all.
That's awesome. We've covered a lot today.
We didn't really talk about extreme, like modern extremists. We just kind of talked about like people who died 150 years ago. But I mean, you know, clearly you're fascinated by Reconstruction, and it's your podcast, so we could talk about whatever. But
I thought
it's not a criticism of anything, but I guess I thought we were going to talk more about like the chuds in my comment section. But we talked about interesting stuff. I mean, I hope people enjoy it.
I mean, to your point, like I just. Like so many people don't want to engage with history. Like I find that on Twitter that it's so ahistorical. It's almost goofy. Like you'll have like
it's meme history, right? It's history and a meme.
Yeah. So you'll have like anti-Trump Republicans, like, the Republican Party has never been this racist. And then you're like, hey, remember that time the Klan supported Barry Goldwater? States' rights.
Yeah.
And then they just, you know, remember that time that Pat Buchanan wrote that white nationalist book? That was in 1992. And it just, you know, I think like my own attitude became like, I don't want to focus on, like, I want to go back into the roots and kind of look at the roots and think about like, you know, how do we as millennials kind of tackle the lost cause, or how do we, you know, bring the deep history and the deep lore to an audience that, you know, might have missed it, like Reconstruction. Like I have found out that, you know, besides AP history and maybe some graduate courses, not a lot of people get exposed to, you know, Eric Foner's treatment of Reconstruction. And then especially they never get exposed to Free Soil, Free Men, sort of the ideology going into the Civil War. Like your 50 minutes on states' rights, that video was, in my view, is close to perfection in the sense of
it's not perfect. close to perfection.
Close to.
I thought you said you were a fan.
Not enough Predators. There wasn't like if you had thrown in a Predator. But like the idea of showing that, you know, ideology isn't just something that just comes up in 5 years. It's something that took 30 years. And it's like this legal discussion that you keep seeing again and again, over and over again. You keep seeing the repetition of states' rights. Right. And it's like, you know, the libertarians of the 60s, 50s and 60s are saying, you know, can't have a federal statute for civil rights. Why states' rights? Right.
Yeah,
and it's, and then you kind of trace that back and it's like, well, you know, all these guys in the 1840s and 1850s were kind of making almost, you know, not the exact same argument, but kind of, you know, reaching for that sort of theme of states' rights. So,
well, yeah, it was like that the government shouldn't tell me to not be shitty.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the right, my right to infringe on the rights of people that we all consider subhuman shouldn't be interfered by the government, you know, or that I consider subhuman or whatever. Right. So like that's the whole thing is right. It's, and that's kind of the unfortunate sort of part of that whole train of thought about states' rights is that like, you know, on paper, right. It's a great idea. It's just kind of where it comes. Yeah. Where it's like, there's this fixation on like, well, the federal government can't do anything. You know, you know, even like help dismantle deeply backwards and themselves like authoritarian laws and traditions, right? Like it's the whole thing. Let me put it another way. So it's like, it's fine if the authoritarianism is local. You know what I mean? But as soon as it becomes national, then it's a giant fucking problem. It's the thing about states' rights, what it's almost always been, like despite its origins, which were largely innocuous, what it's almost always been in practice is the government can't tell me to not be authoritarian to my own community. And like, govern it the way that I want. And oftentimes that took either sexist or racist or, you know, otherwise kind of xenophobic sort of applications, right?
But I mean, I think that's, even that is kind of a lie, isn't it? Because like, even if we go back and say like slavery was largely designed to be a local institution, right? Like Alabama, Mississippi can have slavery, but Massachusetts won't. But at the same time, like a lot of, if I'm understanding the history correctly, please, you know, throw tomatoes if I get it wrong. A lot of them demanded that, you know, there would be federal enforcement of slavery. So like the Fugitive Slave Act, the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution, and then I want to say three or four different sort of
Fugitive Slaves. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. No, it's that's the thing, is that it like, it was only, is that that's, you know, the pro-slavery South co-opted and appropriated the libertarian South and basically took their political traditions and their talking points and twisted it to defend slavery and white supremacy. And that's kind of what it became entirely about. Like the vast majority of Confederates, especially, but not by any means exclusively in the Deep South, were, couldn't have fucking cared less about states' rights. It's true. They like could not have fucking cared less. It was just a smokescreen in order to push slavery. Let's keep slavery. Let's expand slavery. Slavery makes us rich. We need to keep slavery, right? It's just, that's what it was like slavery. We can't get rid of slavery. It's too profitable. That is just it. So any excuse, any political talking point that's going to support that, that's going to strike anti-slavery measures down in courts or is going to foible abolitionist activism or whatever, you know what I mean? Or foil, I should say, whatever. Like they will say anything. So yeah, you're absolutely right that it was in many ways just kind of a smokescreen to cover up their true goal, which was to make fuckloads of money, Cena. So much money. They were so wealthy and they made so much fucking money. And that's what it was all about, right? People often, in fact, a lot of lost causers will say, they'll tell me, you know, no, the Civil War was all about money. It was all about control. Of course, they mean that it was about the North hanging on to the South because the South was profitable and they wanted more control and they wanted to expand their empire. But no, it was in fact about the planter class and their sense of and their profit margin and their control over their underclass, over their lower, their untouchable caste, which they believed to relinquish that control would not only obviously lose their profits, which can never happen. Imagine if we stopped making our shitloads of money, but also would lead to apocalypse, would lead to what D.W. Griffith portrayed in Birth of a Nation, which is miscegenation and black men raping white women and Nat Turner all over again, right? But 1,000 times worse. So yeah, it's a very interesting. I mean, you know, I really love getting in the mind of these twisted little fuckers. I do find it very fascinating. Their point of view and their perspective on things. Because yeah, I mean, in many ways, it is obviously like completely backwards by to our modern sensibilities. But yeah, it's still like pretty fascinating. You know,
I mean, it really feels like when I read your comments, like. There are people in your comments that I feel like believe the lost cause or something. Like I can't put my finger on it because it's not straight up trolling. It's not like straight up, haha, Andy, you're wrong. Read a book.
Yeah. There's true believers. Yeah. Yeah.
There's like true believers. And then it's like, I always wondered like how much, if you believe in something like the lost cause, like how much editing you have to do, right? You throw out Longstreet, you throw out the first Klan during Reconstruction, you throw out, you know, the fact that the planter class, this was a war of the planter class, of them kind of saying, you know, we need to secure that bag. So what if, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die or whatever? But like, is there an element of belief? Is it like belief supersedes his like facts?
Well, all of our understanding of history, everybody's understanding of everything is selective, right? Like we can't all be experts on everything. We can't all digest every single source. And a lot of it is like we're told a certain thing when we're young, or we read a certain book that confirms our biases or whatever. And that's just kind of what we think, right? And that's, and we believe, and people believe what they want to believe, right? It's not, you know, I mean, the human capacity for cognitive dissonance is astounding. And, you know, my enemies and the idiots in my comment section have it. I mean, you know, and not all of them are idiots. Like I said, I should watch my word carefully. A lot of them are, but like, you know, like I said, you know, Johnny Reb is the way he is for a reason, right? A lot of the people who believe in the lost cause are just genuinely misinformed and they're good people. But anyway, you know, people in my comment section, you, me, like we all have things that we're cognitively dissonant about, that we heard something that confirmed our biases. So that's what we believe. And we don't know if it's fucking true. We have no idea. Right. I mean, you know, I'm sure the things that a lot of that stuff that we just like, oh, well, that's the way it is. Or like, just that's the natural order of things. Or, well, that's what I've heard all my life. If we just dug into it a little bit, we would find, oh, no, this stuff is like monstrously wrong. Truly like monstrously, right? And you know, and our grandchildren will probably recoil in horror at a lot of the shit that we are just like, oh yeah, well that's just the way it is, right? So yeah, the cognitive dissonance is strong. And so I don't think it's remarkable or even uncommon for people to completely throw out inconvenient truths that don't mesh with their worldview or whatever. And, you know, hey, everybody does this and, you know, there's blame on all sides. You know, I mean, you mentioned sort of bad history on Twitter. I mean, there's a shitload. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, Twitter is of course, famously a very left-leaning place. And while I don't think that historical misinformation on the left side of the spectrum is by leaps and bounds anywhere near as big of a problem as it is on the right side of the spectrum, it's fucking out there. Like there are some fucking like very well-meaning morons, who again will like retweet a fucking meme that like is, you know, that feels very ACAB or whatever the fuck, you know what I mean? Or that's like this inspiring story of this woman 100 years ago, or this, you know, or this person who fought the slave owners or whatever the fuck, Django shit that like has no bearing on reality. I don't know. Yeah. So I guess my point is that like, we are all cognitively dissonant about some things. Many of us cognitively dissonant about many things. And, so we should not be surprised that, so many people out there don't fucking know what they're talking about, because frankly, nobody does. Yeah, we're all fucking idiots and, you know, apes with keyboards. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I mean, speaking of memes, like I have a little project going on where I want to take Reconstruction and meme stream to mainstream it. So like, I'm sure you're aware of like the Sherman meme with the laser eyes, or
yes,
the John Brown meme shirt, like a billion dead Confederates. And so I've been trying to get like Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner on a t-shirt. And then I've quickly found out that in fact, you can't really easily explain like abolitionist politics or the formation of the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments. So I don't consider myself a talented communicator in that respect, because I swear to God, I will literally take a copy of Eric Foner's Reconstruction, go to a bar and like Foner pill people, like just explain to them like like you like Reconstruction. I see you have a anti-fascist pin. Let's talk about the original anti-fascist. which it actually turns out that a lot of people in their 20s and 30s, millennials, zoomers, whatever, they're not into the 800-page tomes. You know, I even pitch it like you can do curls, you can do lifts, like you could swallow, you know, while you're you know, making your brain big. So that's why that is, if you're ever curious, that is part of the origin story of the Loopcast, where I needed a platform or a medium where I could talk at length for 2 hours about dense subjects, nice. like hour and a half on the Turner Diaries. Why not? anyway, I'm sorry. So
it's awesome.
So for my very last question, we usually have the legendary last question, which is give me and the audience, before we adjourn for the night, something to think about. So this can be a phrase, be a sentence, it could be a tangent, it could be whatever you want it to be, but it's something for me and the audience to kind of to think about as we adjourn for the night.
It can be anything.
I mean, yeah, it can be anything. It could be a plug. It could be a phrase. It could be.
I have. This has nothing to do with anything.
It could be whatever you want.
But it's something that I've been thinking about. So, Sina, do you ever find cockroaches in your house?
No, I live on a side of a mountain, so like nothing lives up here, unfortunately.
Gotcha. So,
I'm sorry.
I would just say, anybody listening, the cockroach, when you wake, let's say you wake up in the middle of the night, you go to your kitchen to get a glass of water, you flip on the light, and you see a cockroach skittering away under your sink, or, you know, just fleeing the light. Maybe it was feeding on your dog food. Maybe it was, you know, looking through your trash or something, or you open your trash can and there's a roach and it just kind of like goes in. Right. Statistically speaking, it is very likely that that cockroach came from a cemetery, in the very recent future. So next time, and this isn't just cockroaches, they are some of the biggest offenders, but there are all sorts of other bugs, right? If you live within, you know, a mile of a cemetery, the bugs that you see in your house at night came from there. And they've got a belly full of formaldehyde and human meat. And they're going to leave their droppings all around your kitchen, all around your house. And let's say that they crawl on your spoons, your utensils, you know, the surfaces that you cook on. Maybe they even go for a little ride on your toothbrush. Those cockroaches, they came from a grave. So that's just something I was thinking about today. So I hope everyone sleeps well tonight.
Thank you for that spooky ending. That was very spooky. That was Andrew from, I'm going to try to pronounce this, Atunche Films.
Atunche.
Atunche. Atunche.
Atunche Films.
We will have a link to his YouTube channel. I will have, we'll have links to some of our favorite Checkmate Lincolnites episodes. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah. So just so, just so I could do some, if I could do some shameless self-promotion.
No, go ahead.
Please check out my channel. There's all sorts of creepy cockroach content. Checkmate Lincolnites is what I'm best known for, but I do a number of other, when I'm just out and about in the world thinking about history or reading books, Civil War is maybe, 20% of the stuff that I actually think about or where my interests lie. I do all sorts of stuff. I live in New Orleans. I do a lot of local history. I'm from New England. I do a lot of New England history, especially the Puritan period. I've got a couple of other kind of web series type of things. There's one called Witchfinder General, which is about a 17th century Puritan who reacts to modern pop culture and movies and memes and all sorts of stuff. As you can imagine, he thinks it is quite sinful in fairly amusing ways. And a lot of his dialogue is taken straight from 17th century witch hunting manuals. I've got another web series called Frozen 50s Man, which is a similar vein, which is about a private detective from the 1950s cryogenically frozen and wakes up in the 2020s, partners up with a socialist hipster, and they solve crimes. I also directed a movie called The Sudbury Devil, which is a feature film set in 17th century Massachusetts that is done filming and is in post-production. It should be coming out hopefully sometime next year, but we will see. It'll definitely be finished next year, but keep your eye out for it and watch some of the update videos that are on my channel. I think it is by far the best thing that I've ever done. So, and it's shaping up to be very good. So I hope you check it out. And Sina, thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Oh, thank you.